Thanks so much for joining us on a lovely Saturday. What a surprise. We had to wait till the final day of the month, and then we get a January thaw in a big way, Tom.
You know, we're reminded again how wonderful summer is in Minnesota, although it's short.
That's right. This is it. Yeah, enjoy. 41 degrees in the Twin Cities, so it is a very beautiful day. We invite you to give us a call on the program. We'll set the stage in a moment. We want to put those phone calls out early for Minnesota Law if you want to jot those down. 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. And we have a fascinating topic in the spotlight today, Tom.
That's right, Steve. And it's very timely in light of the economic turmoil that we're going through because, you know, so many people are in the process of transitioning from one job to another. Maybe in that process thinking of starting up their own businesses. And so the issue for today that we're going to be talking about in that regard is what types of information can an employee use in a new employment as opposed to what might be protected from being used under the law of trade secrets. And this is an important issue precisely because it affects all aspects of the equation, not only the former employer's rights in trade secrets, but also the employee's rights to move to a new employer, and could also affect the new employer's potential liability if an employee brings improperly brings trade secrets to the new place of work, and thus embroils the new employer in a lawsuit over trade secret misappropriation. And so with that in mind, we have with us as a guest Moss & Burnett shareholder Matthew Kostolnik. He is an active practitioner in the litigation and trial department at Moss & Burnett. And Matthew graduated from the University of Minnesota Law School and also from St. John's here in Minnesota. So welcome, Matthew. I understand that your family, your three children, your wife and grandparents are even right now listening to the show with a very special birthday party going on.
We hope they are huddled around the radio right now, and this afternoon we will be celebrating the birthday of my middle child, my son Joe.
Very good. Well, I'm sure that'll be a lot of fun, and so you'll be there in time to enjoy all of that. Well, as we talk about trade secrets, I imagine a lot of folks imagine that we're talking about, you know, secret ingredients or formulas or even, you know, processes that are used to make a product or a business successful. And while that's all very true, it also covers many other kinds of potential information. True?
Well, that's right. The statutory definition under Minnesota law of a trade secret is very broad, and generally speaking, we're talking about information that in and of itself is economically valuable because of the fact that it is not well known or readily ascertainable by others. And so within that broad definition, there are many types of different information that can fit within and be considered trade secret.
And so as we look into this part of the law, we have to take a look at what the law says, but also maybe give some practical examples. I mean, I suppose it's commonplace that the recipe for Coca-Cola is in some measure a trade secret.
The formula for Coca-Cola is the classic example of a trade secret, and it is said that that formula is kept in a bank vault. It almost rises to the level of legal urban legend in terms of how that information is protected. I have heard that no one person knows the entire formula for Coca-Cola by heart. I have also heard, contrary, that there are persons who do know, some top-level employees, and those persons are never, much like the Vice President and President of the United States of America, not allowed to travel together on the same plane for fear that their knowledge would be lost potentially. So that's correct. The formula for Coca-Cola is the classic example of a trade secret.
Well, and I'm sure it's one of those things where people would try to reverse engineer that, but Coca-Cola would never dare confirm or deny that people have been able to match that. I'm sure there's attempts to figure it out in other ways.
Well, you bring up a great point, Steve, and the reality is that reverse engineering is one way to get around trade secret protection. However, with respect to reverse engineering, in most cases, we're going to be talking. We should be talking about someone who isn't going to arrive at the foundational information necessary to reverse engineer a trade secret by virtue of a for employment relationship, for example. It should be someone who is coming at that information on their own.
And another recipe that comes to mind we should bring up is Kentucky Fried Chicken. I've heard that that is a closely held secret as well.
Exactly.
Maybe not on the level of Coca-Cola, but I've heard that as well, that, you know, the Colonel's secret recipe is really that.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And of course, so is my wife's, you know, favorite spaghetti sauce. But we'd be happy to share that for a nominal charge.
Will you put that online?
Exactly.
Moss-Burnett.com.
And so a trade secret does have to, as Matthew is pointing out, have to be secret to begin with. And steps have to be taken to keep it secret, but it can be lost if it's disclosed or becomes a matter of the public domain.
That's correct. And one of the defenses that we see raised in trade secret litigation all the time is that the information is not, in fact, something that is kept under lock and key at the employer's place of business, but instead is something that falls within the public domain. And a good example of that might be information which is called from a number of public sources that the employer then uses in the context of that business. But in fact, because it has it's grounded or rooted in information that is already in the public domain, would in fact likely fall outside the protection of trade secret law.
Sometimes the people who are taking trade secrets actually do a fair amount of industrial espionage work to remove their information. And I know you had a colorful example involving Coca-Cola.
Well, there was a case from a couple years ago which emphasizes how important trade secrets can be to an employer, especially when you're talking about a trade secret that rises to the level of really the formula for the key product in a company's product line. And in this particular case, there was a top-level executive secretary who had conspired with two outsiders to steal information related to a new product at Coke and sell it to Pepsi. And this was a scheme which involved a potential payment of $1.5 million. This person was literally caught on security cameras at Coke stuffing documents into her attaché case, then providing them to these two outsiders who wrote a letter to arch-rival Pepsi suggesting that they would sell these secrets to the highest bidder. Pepsi, in a spirit of cooperation not often found between arch rivals, did in fact tip off Coke, who got the authorities involved, and all three persons involved were prosecuted under federal criminal law and sentenced to jail time.
And now more recently, we've seen the concept of trade secrecy come into play in connection with the controversy surrounding the use by banks of this Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP money.
Well, as we well know, there's been a hue and cry related to how those funds have been distributed, and there has been an alleged lack of transparency both by the Fed and the bank recipients of those funds. Now, one of the pushbacks that we have seen by the banks and by the Fed has been that to disclose such information would constitute disclosure of a trade secret. For example, how banks make decisions related to who they lend to and who they choose not to lend to can, in fact, provide those banks with a competitive advantage in the marketplace, and that competitive advantage would be lost if that information were disclosed to others. Bloomberg News Corp has, in fact, commenced a lawsuit against the Fed to try and compel disclosure of that information, and, of course, we'll see how that plays out. But it goes to the fact that this information is of the type that could be considered trade secret, even in the context of something as large and massive as the TARP.
Wow. And the one thing we do know is that some of the money has gone to very nice bonuses at the end of 08. We do know that much. That was not a trade secret. We found that out, that billions went in bonuses.
That's exactly right. And, of course, good for us to be knowing all of that. And I understand, though, to Matthew's point, that the Obama administration has, in fact, backed off somewhat on its push to explore and publicize where the TARP money was spent, if it was, by these large bankers.
We will take a break. We have more coming up. We have trade secrets in the spotlight. Matthew Kostelnik is joining us from Moss and Barnett. Tom Schreier, the host of the program, of course. Our phone number is on the program, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett each and every Saturday at noon here on News Radio. 830-WCCO.com. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett each and every Saturday at noon. Tom Schreier is our host. And today, investigating and litigating trade secret claims under Minnesota law. Trade secrets in the spotlight today. Matt Kostelnik is in studio today on a lovely day. 41 degrees in the Twin Cities. The first day this month over 30 degrees, and we go all the way to 41.
It's astonishing, and what a great day to be here in studio, in the Buick studio with you all. And Matthew, we're talking about trade secret law here, and we were talking a bit ago about reverse engineering. Steve mentioned that concept. And what does that mean exactly, and what effect does that have on whether or not something is a trade secret?
Well, essentially, reverse engineering is a way to take a finished product or a finished something that qualifies as a trade secret information and to take it and split it up into its component parts to attempt to arrive at what exactly that trade secret entails. And one of the things that we can talk about here is perhaps the difference between a patent and a trade secret, and why perhaps a company might go the route of not patenting certain information and instead attempting to have it qualify as trade secret.
And for example, we know that Coca-Cola has not patented its formula, which it has held in secret since the late 1890s.
That's correct. Instead, they have gone the route of trade secret, the reason being that trade secret does not compel disclosure of any information that encompasses that trade secret. In fact, keeping the information secret is a necessary prong of meeting the trade secret test, whereas with a patent application, by necessity, it compels a person, an owner of that information, to make certain disclosures in order to qualify for the protection. So there are certain businesses who will make a strategic determination that one route is better than the other, and of course that would vary on a case-by-case basis.
And so the difference then fundamentally between a patent and a trademark, or a patent and a trade secret, excuse me, is that when one applies for a patent, as we found out when we had David Beek in a couple of times here this fall, a party has to describe the invention in the patent application, and the patent itself has to describe the invention sufficient to, as the word is, enable users and observers of the patent to replicate it.
Well, that's absolutely right. And additionally, and equally as important, is that that patent protection does have a set time limit of typically 20 years, whereas trade secret protection can last indefinitely.
So the trade-off between a patent and a trade secret is that with a patent, one gets a legal monopoly for a certain number of years to practice the invention or license it for use by others, whereas in a trade secret, nobody can know how to repeat it or replicate it, and therefore it belongs to the owner in perpetuity.
And that's right. It can be indefinite, but of course one must always be vigilant to guard against that trade secret falling into the public domain or being reverse engineered or something else that would cause that trade secret protection to lapse.
Now, sometimes employees are left to wonder, you know, what exactly is a trade secret? Is that something that an employer should be careful to make sure to point out to employees?
Most definitely, and it really is a discussion that can arise at any point in time in the employment relationship. With respect to new hires in particular, it is especially important for both sides to have a clear understanding of exactly what is expected of them. It's a discussion that should occur during the hiring process. If, in fact, the employer does know that trade secrets will be necessarily divulged to an employee in the context of that employee doing business, then the employer does need to think about having an employment agreement with restrictive covenants in place. Then throughout the employment relationship, there should also be handbooks, manuals, memos, et cetera, reiterating the policy of the employer that certain information is trade secret, not to be disclosed. And then, of course, there are special considerations at the termination of the employment relationship that would also be in play.
Would pricing or price lists be considered trade secrets? Because in a lot of businesses, people manufacture items and then sell them at another price. Are those considered generally trade secrets?
Well, it's a good question. The answer is it depends, but quite typically, the more detailed that information is, the more likely it may fall within trade secret protection. Things like gross margins, like purchasing history of a specific customer, markups, any information really that goes beyond a simple list of a customer together with contact information adds to the level of potential trade secret status. And so employers should be encouraged, on the one hand, to assemble as detailed of information as they can, knowing, of course, that adequate safeguards are going to need to be in place. But the reality is that adding that level of detail that comes with a lot of hard work, a lot of experience, a lot of history with a particular customer, and adding to that layer of specificity makes it more likely that trade secret protection will be enforced by the courts.
And, Tom, we did a show on non-competes. It seems like these two would dovetail together, that identifying trade secrets and crafting non-competes would go hand in hand.
They sure do. And as Dave Jendrzejek explained when he was on the show to talk about non-competes last summer, non-compete agreements really restrict the ability of an employee to work in a certain industry or with certain customers, whereas trade secret law restricts the ability to leave an employer and take information specific to the employer.
And I would add on to that that it is important for the employer to make sure, if an employment agreement is going to be in play, to decide to what extent are these restrictive covenants going to be in the employment agreement. Non-competes that govern the end of the employment relationship in terms of who a particular employee can work for or not work for within a certain geographic limitation are important. But equally as important, especially in the case of an employee who's going to have access to trade secret information, is what that person can do with that information upon the conclusion and termination of the employment. So that would be a non-disclosure point.
Well, we're going to take a break. We'll have more. Matt Kostolnik joins us in studio. Tom Schroyer is here. Trade Secrets in the Spotlight today, Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Burnett here on CCO. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Burnett, each and every Saturday at noon. Tom Schroyer is our host. Matt Kostolnik is our guest attorney today, investigating and litigating trade secret claims under Minnesota law. And there's a lot of great examples of trade secrets, and they really come in all shapes and sizes. It's not particularly blueprints or formulas.
That's right. In fact, some of the information is what we might call soft-sided trade secret information, along the lines of contact information for customers, pricing information. And so, Matthew, when and under what circumstances are those kinds of bits of information capable of being protected by Minnesota's trade secrets law?
Well, it very well can fall within the protection of trade secret information, but as we go from the more concrete and specific to the more nebulous and indefinite, it becomes harder and harder both to prove a theft of trade secret information as well as to qualify under the statute for relief. And really the answer depends a lot upon the particular employment relationship involved, what's been defined within the context of an employment agreement or manual or policy or something else that governs the relationship during the course and scope of employment.
And I imagine a non-disclosure agreement or a confidentiality agreement with an employee can spell out these kinds of things, and probably ought to if they want to have it protected from the employer standpoint.
I tell you, it really should be well known during the hiring process what might be expected, of course, without divulging anything at that point in time, because presumably there's not a controlling agreement in place to protect the information. But then also during, at the moment of hire with the employment agreement, during the context of the employment relationship, and then, of course, at termination. In that instance, it might be one of the most important times to most clearly have a discussion in terms of what the clear expectations are of both the employee and the employer.
I know we see many occasions in our firm when we have litigation surrounding these matters where there's a real tug of war between the salespeople on the one hand and the employer on the other, because the salespeople, naturally enough, I tend to feel that the names on the customer list, their telephone numbers, addresses, email information and the like is really information that they, the salespeople, have developed over the years, hanging out and getting business cards and referrals and chasing down leads, whereas the employer's standpoint or perspective is that belongs to the business because that's where the rubber hits the road in terms of driving sales for the company.
Well, that tension between employer and employee also carries into the law, and we see the same tension in the cases which we as lawyers apply to the situations which we find ourselves litigating in Minnesota courts. The reality is that there is no bright line when it comes to this information that's developed during the course and scope of the employment agreement, in particular with particular respect to information that your typical salesperson might be developing. I mean, it really does need to be defined by the employer in the context of all the agreements. There needs to be clear expectations that this information, even if it is developed by the employee, is going to be considered a trade secret by the employer. But at the same time, Minnesota courts have routinely held that an employee is not required to, quote-unquote, erase their memories upon termination. To the extent that they have developed a relationship with these customers, to the extent that they know where they live, who their spouses are, what they enjoyed in their free time. I mean, these are all things that are going to fall outside the context of trade secret protection and is going to be a much more tough case for the employer to try and prosecute under trade secret law in Minnesota.
So that kind of know-how, it's sometimes called, that is learned on the job, that type of information is really best protected, it would appear, from using a non-compete agreement versus trying to rely upon the trade secret law.
Well, that's very true, and I think it's an important distinction that's brought up here is that trade secret law is independent of an employment agreement, and it's also independent of the implied duty of loyalty that is found between an employee and an employer in every employment relationship. So the point is that there are multiple ways in which information can be protected and also multiple ways in which one can potentially run afoul of the law in Minnesota.
Now, sometimes understanding from my litigation experience and our discussion here offline, getting ready for the program, sometimes it makes a difference as to how the information is obtained by the employee. That is to say, if the employee has memorized, for example, the names of their customers and addresses, well, then that is most often deemed by the courts to be know-how. But if the employee does something surreptitiously to get that information, like making a copy or a computer download, that can have an important effect in terms of how a court looks at whether the information is trade secret protected or not.
Oh, absolutely, and I think the point perhaps, or one of the points that question entails is don't get greedy. I mean, if you're thinking about leaving the employment relationship, it might pay to not take those documents, to not download the information to a personal computer or via an email account, and instead take nothing if the employment relationship calls for that under the specific circumstances of a person's employment relationship. And something we've heard throughout our lives, but oftentimes it can be said in this situation that honesty is the best policy, because it's oftentimes the person who surreptitiously takes information and leaves under the cover of darkness that is going to be the subject of a lawsuit down the line.
Do computers and email create a gray area? Because, well, email correspondence, is that personal? Is it company property? Maybe you use a personal email account for business and correspond with customers. Does that become a gray area in the law?
Well, I think where we see it become a gray area is with the difficulty that it entails in terms of protecting that information. With more and more employees using perhaps personal email accounts and personal laptops to do their work, it becomes that much more difficult to make sure that trade secret information does not fall within the public domain or is otherwise disclosed, thereby voiding that trade secret protection that that would ordinarily be present.
Well, and of course, it is commonplace in court decisions that once, for example, a price quote or bid or even pricing or terms are supplied to a customer or a prospective customer, then that information has entered the public domain and is no longer trade secret protected. And so that has to be taken into account, too, in terms of what kind of information can be protected. But getting back to the point we're on, it's of course, reminds us of the unfortunate case between the two local newspapers here, where one editor or publisher jumped from one paper to the other and turned out had taken a copy of the names of advertisers and their pricing and contact information, and that was held to have been a breach of duty of loyalty and confidentiality.
Well, that's right. In that particular case involving the two Minnesota dailies, there was an alleged breach of an employment agreement. There was information contained on a laptop that was brought to the new employer, and there was a solicitation of employees, in this case from the Pioneer Press to the Star Tribune. And all of those were in play during the context of this lawsuit. And one of the things, and we've talked about, Steve, you brought up what effect does technology have on these on trade secret litigation. What we see more and more is orders from the court compelling a search vis-a-vis computer forensic search of laptops, of computers, to try and ascertain exactly what went out the door when an employee left the former employer.
Exactly right. In fact, not only office laptops and computers, but also home computers, which can raise all kinds of other issues in terms of the kinds of information that people have on their home computers, can be searched forensically under court order in these circumstances when there's been a claim of a theft of trade secret. Even a cell phone and a PDA, such as a BlackBerry or a similar device, can be examined forensically, and the amount of detailed information that is able to be gleaned from these devices is simply stunning to me.
Well, it sure is, and what is remarkable is that a skilled computer forensic investigator really can find out fingerprint, if you will, exactly what happened, when, what was taken, etc. And this type of investigation, as you might imagine, can get fairly expensive. And one thing an employee may wish to consider before that person takes information is whether or not in an employment agreement there is a fee-shifting mechanism that might require that employee or the current employer to bear the cost of that computer forensic investigation, or perhaps the lawyer's fees involved in prosecuting a theft of trade secret claim.
I know we worked on some matters here earlier this year together, Matthew, in which employees tried to use a thumb drive to download some information, presumably on the view that there would be no record left behind of having done that, but that wasn't the case.
No, it's not the case. And when it comes to the insertion of a thumb drive or flash drive or some external storage device, these computer forensic investigators are going to be able to find out exactly when the device was inserted. I mean, literally going down to the second, we'll be able to determine which files were accessed at that time. And by inference, we'll then be able to tell what was presumably uploaded to the thumb drive. And then, of course, that information, once it's on the thumb drive, could go anywhere, but oftentimes would go to a personal laptop or perhaps even the new employer's computer system. And now all of a sudden we're talking about liability, perhaps, of the new employer.
What can a new employer do to safeguard against being held liable for unknowingly, inadvertently hiring someone who is bringing trade secrets with them and, for obvious reasons, doesn't want to tell the new employer about it because they hope to gain advantage from it?
Well, the new employer should take care to, during the hiring process, not solicit information that could arguably be seen as attempting to solicit trade secret information. And then, in addition, we've talked about the employment agreements, but one can also request that the employee sign an agreement that employee is not subject to any restrictive covenants or employment agreements that would cause any sort of interference in terms of that employee's ability to do their job at the new employer.
Now, are there potential criminal ramifications for taking information from an employer, either trade secrets or even perhaps by virtue of taking computerized information?
Oh, yeah, both. In fact, there's the I believe it's called the Electronic Espionage Act, which is a federal statute which can cause criminal penalty. Also, there is a statute, 18 U.S.C. 1030, which also is in the context of computer crimes, which may also be in play in certain cases.
Matt, you brought something up, and it maybe plays into this. Pepsi got wind of this controversy with Coca-Cola that there was an employee or two or three that were trying to steal a secret and maybe sell it to the highest bidder. Pepsi got in contact with Coke. Would that be wise if a potential new employer had some concerns about a new employee and some trade secrets? I mean, is that maybe the course of action in a case like that, to bring it to the authorities or to to the other party and say, look, we think there could be a problem here?
Well, yeah, it would be a situation where it needs to be carefully considered for sure, because one can with certainty predict that there's going to be litigation and potential criminal penalties down the road in a situation where such an important trade secret has been disclosed, misappropriated, and then directly disclosed to a competitor. And so given the high-stakes world that we see here in trade secret litigation in today's day and age, and especially the electronic information that we're seeing so widespread, it is, in fact, something that should be given careful consideration.
We have more. Matt Kostelnik is in studio. Tom Schreier, the host. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Here on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Each and every Saturday at noon here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Final segment. The show's gone very quickly today. Our phone number is 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. Trade secrets in the spotlight. Matt Kostelnik in studio. Tom Schreier, the host on our program. Let's bring in George. George is calling in. George from Victoria. Hello.
Hi, guys. How you doing today?
Just fine, thanks.
I worked for a software company out of California that I was separated from on the 2nd of January. And in my separation agreement, I was trying to get a release from a non-compete clause that I signed as a prerequisite of joining on with them. I'm wondering how enforceable those non-compete clauses are. They won't agree to giving me an outright release, which is what I asked for. And I'm just wondering how much jeopardy I have on my side as far as a new company. I will most likely go to work for a competitor because that's the industry I'm in. That's the kind of software I sell.
Well, thanks for calling. We do appreciate the call. And I would say that you raise an excellent question, especially in this era of a significant number of job reductions. People are going to have that question a lot. The answer is that a non-compete agreement can be enforced even in the context of a layoff or a termination of someone's employment. And, of course, it will depend on many, many factors, as, for example, whether you were given adequate consideration for that agreement when you entered into it, and also as to whether or not the terms of the agreement are overly broad to protect the employer's legitimate interests. All of that said, other factors come into play, such as the length of time that might be needed by the employer, and at least in the court's opinion, to protect the employer's interest in this context, all of which are highly variable and depend upon the unique facts and circumstances of your situation. One added factor that I think will come into play increasingly here is that in an era of difficult economic times, courts may struggle to enforce non-compete agreements quite as to the same degree as they did when employment was more readily available. So I think the short answer is that, yes, you may still be subject to a non-compete agreement, but you should talk to a lawyer specifically for an examination, a careful examination, in fact, of all of the competing interests there to see exactly what your rights might be.
One thing also that George brought up, I believe, was that he was talking about a California company. And so if I were advising George and I were to see one thing I would want to see is that employment agreement and a question about the geographic scope of any non-compete limitation in that agreement. I'd want to see things like if there's a venue or jurisdiction clause in that agreement that would require George to travel from Minnesota to California if a lawsuit were, in fact, commenced as a result of some activity. And so it does bring up some very potentially unique circumstances.
Well, and not the least of which, as you're just alluding to, Matthew, is the possibility that California law governs that agreement, not Minnesota law. And I know California has a greatly different view of non-compete agreements and their enforceability than does Minnesota, as established by their state legislature. So many factors come into play here, and it is quite an interesting area of the law. Matthew, we are still moving forward and talking about trade secrets here and, of course, welcoming questions about that and non-compete agreements as well because they're so closely interrelated. What are the legal options that a victim of trade secret theft has, and how should they go about enforcing them? And I know we don't have much time, so you'll want to be brief.
Well, quickly, someone facing a theft of trade secret law needs to commence an investigation yesterday. that investigation has to happen with just an incredible amount of resources thrown at it to try and obtain the threshold evidence necessary to march into court and commence a lawsuit and obtain what is called an injunction. And an injunction would be allowed expressly under the trade secret law in cases where there is going to be an actual or threatened misappropriation. And I do want to add that with respect to a threatened misappropriation, oftentimes that's used as a defense against an injunction. But if someone is successful in proving an inevitable disclosure, an injunction will nonetheless issue. The point here is that this, if a litigated case is the from commencement to trial is the equivalent of a marathon, this type of situation is a sprint. A lot of activity is going to happen in a very short amount of time. It's very fun for the lawyers in terms of the amount of activity that we're involved with, and it's a very serious instance for the employer who is facing that trade secret misappropriation.
And it's so key, isn't it, Matthew, to get these cases teed up and presented to the court for hopefully injunctive relief, because once the customer is lost, if it is a sales-related trade secret, once that customer is lost, then it becomes almost impossible to pull the customer back to the former employer. And just as importantly, if it has to then go into a regular full-blown court trial as opposed to just having an injunction, that customer has to come into court to testify as to why they made their decision to switch to the employee who jumped ship.
Not only does the employer have a situation here where they need to march into court because of the potential effects of the trade secret misappropriation, but also if an employer is going to wait, that may lend itself to waiver, and it would make it more difficult to argue that there is a need to protect this information if, in fact, there is a lengthy period of time delay in terms of commencing a lawsuit.
Well, Matt, great to meet you. The hour went very quickly today. Enjoy the beautiful day. It's 41 degrees.
Steve, I've listened to your Sports Saturday show, checking on MIAC football scores
for years.
Oh, great, and so it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, and the Johnnies win a lot, don't they?
They have.
They tend to do that.
That's why I like to hear the scores.
All right. Matt, have a great day. Tom, as always, have a great day. Next week, another great program lined up.
That's right. We'll have Jim Rubenstein here to talk about Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings. Very timely and fascinating.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Melissa Barnett.